who happened to be a pastor. He had an argument with a member of the congregation who was also a friend of his wife. In the midst of their argument, this friend mentioned that she wanted to help the pastor's wife work through an issue. The pastor responded, "If my wife wanted help with this problem, she would go talk to someone she trusts and respects." He was not saying what his wife felt about this woman. He was saying how he felt about her in a devious way. Both his dislike and his insinuations inflicted pain. That is passive aggression, and it can be devastating. Assertive communication. So if these are the communication styles that grow out of being powerless and afraid of the truth, what communication style grows out of being powerful and loving the truth? The answer is assertive communication. The core belief of assertive communication is, you matter, and so do I. My thoughts, feelings, and needs matter, and so do yours. Assertive communicators refuse to have relationships or conversations where both people do not have a high, equal value. They are not afraid to show the other person what is happening inside of them. Because they value what is inside of them, they take the time and effort to understand their thoughts, feelings, and needs in order to find words to express them clearly and honestly. This process enhances their ability to value and understand what another person communicates to them about their own heart. This is the core value of honor and mutual respect. This is the value assertive communicators protect as they interact. Assertive communicators are unafraid of being powerful and letting other people be powerful within a relationship or a conversation. In fact, they insist on having two powerful people in every conversation. They refuse to give in to the temptation to turn into a T-Rex, a chocolate-covered dragon, or a goat, and they confront the other person if they see them slipping into these roles. A powerful assertive communicator responds to a powerless person with, "What are you going to do about it?" They respond to an aggressive person with, "I can only talk with you when you decide to be respectful." And they respond to a passive-aggressive person with, "We can talk later when you choose to be responsible and tell me what is really going on." In other words, they are able to set consistent boundaries around a conversation so that it stays respectful, and they require both participants to equally participate in pursuing the goal of the conversation. The first goal of conversation: understanding, not agreement. Some people think that talking is communicating. But talking is not communicating unless it has a goal, a purpose. Most often in communication, the goal is agreement. But if our goal is agreement, then what happens when we disagree? I must persuade you to agree with me, or vice versa. But unfortunately, persuasion has a way of slipping into pressure, manipulation, and control. The priority of agreement demands that there really can't be two different people in the conversation. There can only be one. The longer you refuse to respond to my efforts to convince you to agree with me, the more anxiety grows in the conversation. Before long, the battle lines are drawn, and we are allowing our need to be right to overtake our need to protect our connection. The conversation becomes a fight over which one of us has the right perception, the right answer, or the right decision. If we are not careful, it will only be a matter of time before one of us introduces some kind of relationship killer to the conversation. A relationship killer is a message that invalidates or disqualifies one person's thoughts, feelings, or needs in some way. It most often happens when someone mentions his or her feelings and the other person responds, "Well, that's not logical. You can't be right because you just have a feeling." We can't measure your feelings. We have to present things logically. Your feeling doesn't even make sense. My perspective, on the other hand, has all the qualifiers to be valuable. The underlying message, although unintended, is, "I am valuable and you are not." When people start devaluing one another's thoughts, feelings, or needs in some way, they are attacking their connection like a pack of wolves. If connection is a priority, then the goal of communication cannot be agreement, because then one person has to disappear when there is disagreement. And guess what? People do not always agree. If we want to keep two powerful people involved and connected in a conversation, the first goal in the conversation must be to understand. The person whose goal is to understand says, I want to understand your unique perspective and experience. I want to understand the truth of what is happening inside of you, and I want you to understand the same things about me. If I understand your heart, then I can move toward you in ways that build our connection. I can respond to your thoughts, respect your feelings, and help meet your needs. The results of this conversation are going to be radically different from the ones whose goal was agreement alone. Pursuing the goal of understanding will help you progress through increasingly deeper levels of honesty in order to build true intimacy and trust in a relationship. Moving from facts and cliches to feelings and needs. When we are first getting to know someone, our conversations are usually centered on the world around us. We exchange facts and cliches such as the following. How are you? Fine. How are you? Great. What's new? Not much. Beautiful day. Sure is. It's supposed to be 80 degrees today. It says so right here in the paper. Oh, look at that. This conversation requires a very minimal level of connection or vulnerability. You could probably have it with an absolute stranger. Sadly, there are many people who camp out at the level of facts and cliches in their relationships. They usually choose to do this because they tried to graduate to the next level of intimacy and communication in the past. They got scared and hurt. They ended up in those big, long, disrespectful relationship killer conversations and got so burned that they decided it was safer to retreat to communication that requires no vulnerability or risk whatsoever. They use communication to pursue the goal of distance and disconnection rather than connection. The only way you can build a heart-to-heart connection with someone is to communicate on a heart-to-heart level about your feelings and needs. This is the level where we express vulnerability and build trust. This is the level where we get in touch with the truth about who we are and how we affect the people around us. Perhaps you've heard the joke about the man who goes to the doctor and complains about suffering from terrible constant gas. But it's the weirdest thing, doctor, he says. I don't make a sound and it doesn't smell. The doctor looks at him and says bluntly, okay, well, the first thing we're going to do is get you hearing aids. And then we're going to figure out what's wrong with your nose. This is what many of us experience every day when we try to communicate. There's a lot going on around us that we don't always pick up. Sometimes we are completely unaware of how other people are experiencing us. I love to tell people about how my wife experiences the way I drive up Buckhorn Mountain on the way to Weaverville, California. This stretch of road features superb twists and turns, which are perfect for weaving in and out of traffic. The risk of plummeting hundreds of feet to your death lies only a few feet away. When I'm driving, I fly around these corners, passing every car I can overtake. It is marvelous. My wife always has a completely different experience on these drives than I do, an experience I don't understand. I am a good driver, as evidenced by the fact that I have never been in an accident. Personally, I think I should have been a NASCAR driver or at least signed up for a car rally. When she lets me know that she's feeling scared as I am driving, I always think, why are you scared? You have absolutely no evidence that I am a bad driver. You should just calm down and be like me. But as mystifying as it is, I know my wife is not like me, and I cannot make her be like me. I cannot force her to feel what I feel and know what I know. I trust her to believe the best about me, so I know that when she tells me she is scared, she's not insinuating that I'm trying to scare her. She is simply telling me what she feels. If I were to argue with Sherry's feelings, I would devalue her. You shouldn't feel that way. There's no valid reason for you to feel like that. I don't feel like that. Change and be like me. This thought process is as ridiculous as someone saying, I'm hungry, and someone else responding, no, you're not. I'm not hungry, so you can't be hungry. How silly is that? But that is exactly what we do when we respond to others without taking the time to understand, appreciate, and validate their feelings. When I value your feelings, I will not only make it safe for you to communicate them to me, but I will also listen and respond. I will invite you to go deeper and show me what it is you need so we can move forward from understanding to decision-making and action. Understanding one another's needs is the holy grail of communication. If I can find out what you need in a conversation and find out how to satisfy that need, then it changes everything. A drastic turning point in my marriage with Sherry came when she discovered, during a sozo, that she had a deep need to feel protected by me, a need she had never previously identified. Unsurprisingly, it was a need that had never been met in our relationship. It had never occurred to me that she had this need because she had been working to meet that need herself, usually by protecting herself from me. When she had come out of the sozo and told me what she had discovered, I was offended. I had always felt like I was the victim and she was the aggressive offender in our relationship. I blamed her for the fact that I was not courageous. In 15 years of marriage, I had never, not once, thought it was my job to protect Sherry. She had always appeared so self-sufficient. But the Lord confronted me and told me she was right. She needed me to protect her. I listened to God and permanently changed the way I responded to her. At first, she didn't trust me, but after a while, she realized I was going to stick it out. This took us to a totally new place of vulnerability and radically changed our relationship. Her former levels of anxiety dropped dramatically, and our connection strengthened exponentially, all because I can now meet this need in her. The faster you can get to the question, "What do you need?" the faster you can start doing something about it. Unfortunately, because many people are not used to being listened to, they don't know what they need or how to communicate it. They think they have to present a solid case for someone to help them, agree with them, and change for them. For many years, Sherry was a pastor at a school of ministry and frequently had students come into her office to deal with some issue, their emotions flying everywhere. Quietly, she would ask them, "Hey, what do you need?" This question always shocked them. "What?" they'd reply. "What is it that you need?" Sherry repeated. Then it would dawn on them, "I don't even know what I need. Oh my gosh." I have also found that people are usually thrown off guard when I simply show up with this question. "What do you need? Tell me so I can help you with that." It has never crossed their mind that I would help simply because they need something. As soon as they experience it, they immediately recognize it as a practice of intimacy. They feel cared for and loved, which casts out anxiety and helps the search for truth of what their heart needs. You can start practicing the skills of assertive communication by paying attention to your thoughts, feelings, and needs, and respecting their value. Then start doing the same for other people. Check yourself when you're tempted to invalidate someone's experience or heart. Listen to understand in a conversation, especially to understand what a person is feeling and what they need. Seek healing from past experiences that have led you to fear the truth of your heart and become a passive, aggressive, or passive-aggressive communicator. Be real with yourself. If you start slipping into your old styles of communication, then do what needs to be done to make things right. When you commit to becoming the best communicator you could possibly be, you commit to connection and to being a truly powerful person. Not only will your relationship with your heart change for the better, but your relationships with others will be transformed. Chapter 6, The Trust Cycle. In the book of Matthew, Jesus said it is better for someone to tie an enormous rock around your neck, kick you into the deepest part of the ocean, and let you sink, rather than allow you to cause a child to stumble. Apparently, protecting the trust of the vulnerable is a big deal to Jesus, and for good reason. When people mess with your trust at an early age, you are likely to struggle in life. Most gang members, high school dropouts, and addicts have bad childhoods. Most abusers were abused. Most divorcees had divorced parents. Affairs, selfishness, self-inflicted pain, and walls of protection all stem from broken trust during childhood. We were designed to live out of trust. In fact, psychologists argue that trust is the first developmental task every person must achieve in infancy in order to develop a healthy sense of personhood and to develop healthy relationships. When babies come out of the womb, the first question their little heart and mind ask is, "Can I trust the world?" The answer to this question comes as the primary caregiver meets or fails to meet his physical and emotional needs. Babies, like anyone else, have needs. In fact, needs are about all a baby has. And the only thing babies can do to let the world know what they need is to cry. They cry when they are hungry or tired, when they need a diaper changed, when they need to burp, when they need to be held. When they cry and a need is met, a trust cycle is completed. They learn that they can trust themselves, the signals they are sending, and they learn to trust the person meeting their needs. This trust cycle can only be completed through a relational connection, because only a relationship can meet the full range of a baby's needs. If babies are fed, clothed, and washed, but never experience prolonged human touch, cuddling, and face-to-face contact with their primary caregiver, their brains, personalities, and capacity for bonding will remain underdeveloped and, in some cases, permanently stunted. From the moment we enter the world, our deepest need is to love and be loved by other human beings and to engage in lasting relational bonds. Our ability to meet this need develops as we consistently complete trust cycles in our interactions with other people. A trust cycle is completed when you, 1, have a need, 2, the need is expressed, 3, there is a response to the need, and 4, the need is satisfied. Here's the problem. This trust cycle can break down at any point. Trust is damaged if people fail to identify and express their needs, if the other person does not respond to the need or responds in a negative way, or if the need is not ultimately met. Of course, we all experience broken trust in life. Most of us experience it in childhood, simply because all parents, even the best of them, are human beings who make mistakes and bring their own areas of brokenness into parenting. And if these wounds are not healed and truth and trust restored, they will fester, damaging our ability to create intimacy in relationships. Painful experiences give way to wounds that fester when we agree with lies like, God doesn't love me. No one loves me. There's something wrong with me, and that's why I'm unworthy of love. That person would never love me if they really knew me. I don't deserve to have my needs met. Sound familiar? Agreement with these lies creates an expectation for unmet needs. That expectation leads us into more painful, disappointing experiences and prevents the wound from ever healing. If you have experienced SOZO or other forms of inner healing, you know just how one bad experience or one empowered lie can bring significant pain and relational handicaps into your life. For people who grew up in environments where they consistently experienced neglect or punishment in response to their needs, the damage is significant. The cycle of mistrust creates an alienating, painful reality where people feel hopeless about ever having their needs met because they are unable to trust others and form strong relational connections. These people, cut off from love, become survivors. Survivors learn to manipulate their environment and people in order to get some of their needs met. They don't expect to be loved because after years of abandonment, neglect, and abuse, they believe they are unworthy of love. They don't expect relationships to last. Why should they? They are not anyone's beloved. It's never been safe for them to trust or be vulnerable, and they certainly don't have the emotional resources to try to meet anyone else's needs. So they will take what they can get. And what do you know? Survivors end up creating a reality where they are not loved, relationships don't last, and the pain of unmet needs continues to destroy their lives. This is a hallmark of the orphan spirit, the very spirit from which God sent his son to deliver us. Jesus' comment about how serious it is to cause a child to stumble reveals the jealous, protective love of the Father for his lost orphan children, which includes all of us. Jesus went to the cross to avenge the stolen innocence and broken trust we all inherited after the fall. When he declared that we all had to be born again, he was saying, we're going to start this trust thing over again. I'm placing you in the Father's arms where you're going to experience unconditional love, acceptance, and care. He's going to meet your needs when you cry out to him, especially your need to be loved. You're going to learn how to trust again. You're going to be able to build relationships with me and with one another, relationships where your heart will be satisfied. There's no one too broken or too far gone in orphanhood that he or she cannot come to the Father's house to live and love as God designed. This is the heart of the gospel, and that is truly good news. Expressing our needs. Expressing our needs and building relational connections are closely intertwined. In fact, they are completely dependent on one another. As I explained in the last chapter, the level of communication we need to reach in order to build a strong relational connection is the level where we express our needs to one another. It's no mistake that this is exactly where the trust cycle begins. You simply can't build a strong bond of trust without being able to communicate and meet one another's needs. If you cannot communicate your needs to another person clearly, it is obviously going to be very difficult for that person to meet them. That's why one of the primary tasks of reaching maturity is learning how to express thoughts, feelings, and needs. Those who never learn this skill, however, expect relationships to function without it. They say things like, "Well, if you love me, then you would just know what I need. Didn't you notice that that bothered me? Haven't you been paying attention? I can't believe you don't know that about me." Where does this desire or expectation that loved ones have a telepathic ability to know our feelings and needs come from? It comes from powerlessness and fear. It comes from dreaming that everything will turn out magically without actually having to communicate. Powerless people want to win the lottery, get their dream girl or boy with minimal effort, lose weight without exercise, and get their needs met without ever having to say a word. Yeah, well, powerless people, prepare yourself for what I'm about to tell you. It just doesn't work that way. The reason we can't get our needs met without expressing them is that we were designed to have our needs met through a relational exchange. God made us this way. This is how He meets our needs. Think about it. God, the one person in the universe who knows all things and knows us incomparably better than we know ourselves, never says, "Well, obviously I know your needs, so you don't need to tell me about them." Instead, He repeatedly tells us to ask Him for what we need and gives us some of the most profound, beautiful, and honest language for doing so, like the Lord's Prayer and most of the Psalms. He won't meet our needs outside of a connection where we have to show up and crack our hearts open to Him, because that very connection is what we need to have our needs met in the first place. If God Himself respects our prerogative as individuals to make our feelings, needs, and desires known to Him in a relationship, then we may take it that this is how He designed us to relate to one another. In a respectful relationship, each person understands, "I am responsible to know what is going on inside of me and communicate it to you. I do not expect you to know it, nor will I allow you to assume that you know it, and I will not make assumptions about what is going on inside of you." Conversely, the belief that other people can know you or that you can know others without needing to willingly disclose your heart to one another is inherently disrespectful and will lead you to act in ways that damage trust. As long as you believe this, the line of demarcation between your life and another person's life will remain fuzzy, leading you to avoid taking responsibility for communicating what is going on inside of you and to wrongly take responsibility for telling other people what is going on inside of them. Unfortunately, this wrong belief infects most relational communication. So many people think, if I'm in a relationship with you, then I get to tell you about you. Yet, what inevitably happens when you act on this? Here, let me tell you about you. This is what you're thinking and feeling. This is what you need. These are your motives. Comments like this are inherently judgmental, presumptuous, and disrespectful, even if offered in a kind tone with the best of intentions. And unless the person on the receiving end of such comments knows how to set a boundary with disrespect, he or she will usually go into self-protective mode and either shut down or begin retaliating in kind. "So you're going to tell me about me, huh? Okay, then I get to tell you about you." The ensuing duel of judgments is sure to damage any relational connection. If you want to protect your connection and build trust by always communicating respectfully, then your guiding rule must be, "It is my job to tell you about me, and your job to tell me about you." iMessages. The best tool for telling another person about you is an iMessage. The basic structure of an iMessage is, "I feel emotion when describe experience, and I need to feel emotion." Notice that the iMessage begins with "I feel," not "I think." The iMessage is designed to let other people know what is happening inside of you, not for you to let them know what you think about them or what you think they need to do. As you construct an iMessage, make sure you are really expressing a feeling, not an opinion. "I feel like you are a jerk." It's not a feeling. It's an opinion. Because you could replace "feel like" with "think." If you start to say, "I feel like," you should stop and check yourself. Because what is most likely going to follow is not a feeling, but a judgment. And a judgment statement is actually an expression of mistrust, not trust. A judgment statement says, I'm too scared to show you what is really going on inside of me. I'll only feel safe to show you what I'm feeling if you first agree with my assessment of what's wrong with you and then promise never to be like that again. Nothing guarantees raising another person's defenses and hijacking a conversation more than a judgment statement. In their fear, people convince themselves that they can make people change without needing to be vulnerable, rather than trusting people to change by offering vulnerability. These conversations sound like, honey, can I talk to you? Can we share our heart? Can we just have a conversation? Please, please don't get defensive, but I need to share my heart with you. Will you hear it with love? Because this is the truth with love, right here. Here it comes. Ready? Honey, now listen, listen, please listen. Hear my heart. Well, I feel like you are selfish and evil. And for some weird reason, they expect the other person to go, thank you. I was wondering what was wrong with me. Yeah, that never happens. Instead, we need to take the approach that says, I feel a feeling, and it's connected to an event. And when this happened, this is the feeling that I had. And I need to feel something different than what is happening. For example, I feel scared when you drive this fast. I need to feel safe and protected when I'm in the car with you. I need to hear about you and feel valued when we talk. I feel hurt when you talk to me like that. I feel hurt and judged when you frame it like this. When you hit the wall in anger, I feel scared. I feel rejected when you react to my efforts to help you like that. When you send an iMessage like these, you let the other person see your true emotion, then he or she can decide how to respond. You become vulnerable and powerful because you protect the other person's choice to move towards you and meet your needs on their own terms. If you're on the receiving end of the iMessage, you have some decisions to make. Number one, are you going to honor the vulnerability offered, value the person's needs, and figure out how you can meet it? Or number two, are you going to be powerful enough to adjust yourself in order to move toward the person and protect your connection and trust? Both of these choices often require at least as much vulnerability as it took for the other person to show you their need. It is vulnerable, scary, and humbling to allow someone's needs to influence your heart and your actions. But know this, doing your part to complete the trust cycle is just as important for you as for the other person. One of your needs in a relationship is to be able to meet the other person's needs. You need them to receive your love, and you need to know that you are a powerful, trustworthy person who can choose to grow, change, adjust, and do what you need to do to love them in ways that they can receive. It will do wonders for your self-respect. Made for intimacy and freedom. A safe place for intimacy is created when two people can express their needs and consistently complete the trust cycle for one another in a relationship. Intimacy, intimacy, is created between two people who can say, we can be ourselves together because you can see into me and I can see into you. The experience of intimacy, of being completely known and accepted and completely knowing and accepting in return, is the most satisfying experience we can have as human beings. Intimacy in a safe place brings euphoria. Remember the Garden of Eden? Paradise was the place where a man and woman were free to be vulnerable and intimate with one another in every way. The problem is that most of us are scared to death to be vulnerable in relationships. The reason is simple. In being vulnerable, we reach for our greatest need while risking our greatest pain. If acceptance brings euphoria, then rejection brings shame and heartbreak. And by the time most of us reach adulthood, we've had enough painful experiences with rejection that risking our hearts is a serious struggle and one most of us avoid at all costs. The lie that we are inherently unworthy to be loved convinces many of us that hiding is our only option. And because we are hiding, we want everyone else to hide too. We can't handle the truth of who they are any more than we can handle the truth of who we are. If most of us were dropped into the Garden of Eden naked and saw other people running around naked, it wouldn't feel like paradise to us at all. We would freak out and want everyone to cover up as quickly as possible. We just couldn't handle the idea of being exposed. Unfortunately, the fear of rejection and shame sets us up to fall for the enemy's counterfeits. Ever since sin entered the world and humanity became disconnected from God, we have been looking for ways to get our needs met outside of relationship or any scenario where we are required to be vulnerable and risk our hearts. We have always desperately sought the benefit of intimacy without wanting to pay the price. And the enemy continues to offer us the euphoric experiences we think we can control. Things like alcohol, drugs, sex, internet pornography, shopping, carbohydrates, adrenaline, or cash. You use these things to give yourself a euphoric release and take care of your needs. But the counterfeits always have ugly repercussions, like drunk drivers killing innocent people, young kids destroying their brains, men ignoring the beautiful real woman beside them in favor of images, serious debt, morbid obesity, and the host of disease that accompany it, thrill seekers slowly becoming numb to reality, and selfish jerks not caring who they step on to get what they want. Counterfeits never come through. They are the perpetual carrot in front of the horse's nose, promising love, but always out of reach. Whenever you try to get your needs met through control, you end up being controlled and addicted. You lose your freedom. You enter into bondage that prevents the pain that you are trying to self-medicate from ever being healed. We were made to have our needs met through relationships with people we don't control. Love, a free choice, is the only thing that will satisfy our hearts. This is why the counterfeits never live up to their promises. This is why all of us must face our fear of rejection and be healed of shame and risk our hearts and relationships. We must be willing to offer the truth of who we are to those we love and to receive the truth of who they are. Only the truth can make us free. Chapter 7. Communicating in Conflict. When two people choose to walk together in relationship, there is never a question of whether or not they will experience conflict. Believe me, they will. The question is whether they will know what is at stake when conflict happens. The thing at stake, if you're curious, is the health of the relational connection. Conflict is to a relationship what disease or injury is to a body. As with physical health, the goal of relationship should be to prevent as much conflict as possible. However, in the same way that fighting off disease or doing therapy after an injury can strengthen your body, passing through the flames of a conflict in a healthy, productive way can strengthen the relational connection. It is possible to end up on the other side of a conflict as more powerful individuals, freer to be yourselves, more confident in your love for each other, and more hopeful about your ability to meet each other's needs. This positive outcome is dependent, however, on what you choose to do. Will you allow conflict to tear your connection apart, or will you fight for your connection in the midst of conflict? Building a conflict-resistant connection. To recap, here are the core values and guidelines of healthy communication. Our first goal in a conversation is to understand one another. My thoughts, feelings, and needs are valuable and important, and so are yours. I do not participate in disrespectful conversations. When my thoughts, feelings, and needs are devalued in a conversation, I will stop the conversation and set up a clear boundary. Until respect is restored, I will not participate. We need to communicate our true feelings and needs to establish trust and intimacy. It's my job to tell you about what's going on inside of me, and your job to tell me what's going on inside of you. We do not have the powers of telepathy or the right to assume we know one another's motives, thoughts, feelings, or needs. The best way to communicate my feelings and needs to you is to use iMessages and clear, specific statements that show what I am feeling and experiencing. I will not expect you to know my feelings and needs unless I have communicated them to you. I will not make judgment statements or tell you how you must change in order to meet my needs. When you communicate your needs to me, it's my job to listen well so I can understand what you need, how my life is affecting you, and what I can do to meet your needs. I am committed to protecting and nurturing our connection. I will do what I need to do in order to keep moving toward you, no matter what. It's my job to manage my heart so that I can respond to you in love and cast out fear in our relationship. These core values and tools of communication will prevent most conflicts in relationships. Every time you express your needs, set a boundary, listen, meet a need, or speak in one another's love languages, you are nourishing and exercising your connection, keeping it healthy and resistant to harm. Yes, healthy communication often looks like hard work. A vulnerable, honest conversation requires as much energy from your mind and heart as a tough session at the gym. But the benefits of building a strong connection are even more rewarding than the rewards of building a strong body. This is where the promise of Scripture comes into play. Two are better than one, because they have a good return for their labor. If one of them falls down, one can help the other up. But pity anyone who falls and has no one to help them up. Also, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one keep warm alone? Though one may be overpowered, two can defend themselves. A cord of three strands is not quickly broken. So, how strong do you want your cord, your connection, to be? What level of difficulty do you want to prepare your relationship to withstand? What are some of the tests you may be required to face? Answering these questions will help you stay focused and intentional as you keep your relationship in shape. Just like people trying to get lean and healthy, you need to have a goal and regularly remind yourself of what's at stake and meeting that goal to sustain your motivation. It's so easy when things seem to be moving along well in a relationship to ease off the gas and coast. Well, I got her flowers yesterday and I told her I loved her. That should do me for about a week, right? Too many days like this is like eating too many donuts. One day you get up and realize, wow, I feel so far away from you. What happened? You just got lazy, that's all. And though it may not hurt you today, someday soon a conflict is going to pull on that cord of connection and you're going to want it to be strong. So don't back off the Brave Communication Strength Training. If you can pass the test of prioritizing your connection when seas are calm, then you'll be ready to pass the test in the storm. You won't have to worry about that cord becoming so fragile that it breaks under the slightest pressure. Jesus communicated in ways that intentionally tested his connections with people in the Gospels. He confronted people with the truth that he knew they would probably reject. Remember when he announced, "He who eats my flesh and drinks my blood abides in me, and I in him." That one deeply controversial statement was enough to get an entire crowd to walk away from their connection with him. Only the 12 stuck around. Then he asked them, "How about you guys? Are you going to disconnect too?" Well, we can't promise that it didn't cross our minds, but where are we going to go? You have life. The disciples held on to their connection with Jesus, even though they had as many theological and intellectual disagreements with his outrageous words as did every other Jew who heard him. They might have even struggled with the idea of eating Jesus' body and drinking his blood at the Passover meal in the upper room. After all, the true significance of Jesus' words was not unveiled until after his death and resurrection. Yet, despite this and many other mysteries Jesus threw at his disciples, they stayed with him. Jesus purposely created opportunities for his followers to prioritize their connection above offense, confusion, or disagreement. He knew they needed practice if they were to protect their connection to the end. Connection with him was more important than being right. He taught them how to hold on to the most powerful person in the universe, no matter what, and as a result, they turned the world upside down. Sherry and I both affirm that learning to pass a test of connection in the midst of conflict has made us more powerful as individuals and given us a stronger connection than we could have ever imagined. Remember the infamous compatibility test? It didn't lie. On the third day of our honeymoon, we started to realize just how different we were. Our immediate reaction was, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe you're like this. I'm not like that. I don't like that. I would never say that. You scare me. Change and be like me." Finally, after many years of demonstrating that being afraid of one another and trying to change each other was both futile and fatal to our connection, we changed our priorities. We started to say, "Yeah, you are a completely different person than I am. But you get to be you, and I get to be me in this relationship. What do you need? How can I help you with that?" To this day, Sherry and I fall at the opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to personality and temperament. Her needs are very different than mine. Communicating and meeting our needs has required major adjustments and growth in both of us. But after years of responding to one another's needs in love rather than reacting in fear, we have built a connection that is strong enough to face any potential conflict. We went from being relational pudgy weaklings to champion bodybuilders. And while that took some time, I honestly can't imagine anything that has the power to break us apart now. When conflict gets ugly. Conflict becomes dangerously ugly when we react out of fear and pain. Fear feeds conflict because it is in every way opposed to connection. When you can recognize what happens when your natural defenses are triggered by a perceived threat, you can put a plan of action in place to get fear under control and minimize the damage to your connection. Imagine the following scenario. Out of the blue, someone you know approaches you and says, "Hey, we need to talk." Are you hit with racing thoughts and a racing heartbeat? Do you get angry? Do you stay out of sight? Try to weasel your way out of the conversation, make excuses, and dance around the issue? Or do you just shut down? Again, these are all classic fear reactions. Fight, flight, or freeze. And all of them will damage your connection if you let them. Sure, the damage is obvious when you get two fighters together and they turn a verbal spat into a drag-out mortal combat. But it's just as ugly when you get two flight people running away from one another, telling lies, and pretending everything is all right. And then there are the freezers, who simply refuse to engage and turn off their love. It may not look violent, but when you look at how it poisons and starves the life out of a connection, it is definitely ugly. In the early years of our marriage, Sherry was a fighter and I was a freezer. When she was hurt or scared, Sherry went into T-Rex mode. When I saw T-Rex coming at me, I turned into a clam. Needless to say, a conversation between a T-Rex and a clam is not going to be productive. The only thing that came out of those confrontations was enough frustration and hurt to put our connection in the hospital. Resolution was categorically impossible. If you want to avoid ugly, you must have a plan for how you're going to respond when someone pushes the giant red button on your chest and invites you into a duel. There's a real chance that the person who pushed that button is already under the influence of fear, pain, and anger, and may not be ready to manage themselves well in the conversation. Shocking, I know. People always ask me, but what if they don't play by the rules? What if they are mean? In case you failed to notice, scared, hurting people do not play fair. It can be quite disturbing to see fear turn someone who is normally kind and calm into someone who is treacherous, spiteful, and violent. But that is what the spirit of fear does. It brings out the worst in us. If you want to protect your connection, then you need to learn to diffuse fear bombs and constantly steer would-be duels into respectful conversations. Only a respectful conversation is going to be productive in resolving a conflict. Remember, it is your responsibility to set a boundary for how many disrespectful, unproductive, or damaging exchanges you will endure. The moment you pick up your dueling sword, you are equally guilty for whatever blood is shed. I care about your needs. In order to steer a duel towards a respectful conversation, you need to know what a respectful conversation is. A respectful conversation has a goal, and it has a process for achieving that goal. If that other person refuses to agree to that goal and engage in the process, the conversation will fail in the respectful category. The goal of a respectful conversation is to strengthen your relational connection by discovering what a person needs and how you can meet that need. However, getting a hurt and scared person to show you what they need can be tricky. Often, the first issue you'll need to confront is their belief that you do not care about their needs. As I mentioned before, this is the belief I first work to expose when people come to me with a problem. I simply ask, "What do you need?" If they anticipated that I would not care about their need, this catches them off guard. They plan to try to convince me to care without even telling me what was going on first. Instead of communicating a problem, they plan to communicate a solution. It's pretty impossible to create a solution to a problem if you don't know what that problem is. And you're not going to identify the problem unless you are willing to admit what you need and trust me to care about that need when you show it to me. This is where people must confront their deepest fears of vulnerability and rejection. It's not easy, but true conflict resolution, the kind that heals and strengthens a relational connection, will not be achieved without it. Trying to convince someone to care about your needs without being vulnerable enough to communicate them is an exercise in futility. Yet so many people fall into this fear-driven pattern. See if you can relate to this situation. A wife has been stewing all day about how she feels disconnected and unloved by her husband. He walks in the door from a long day at work and sets his keys on the counter. He sees her, lying in wait like a lion about to attack its prey. A little unnerved, the husband takes a step into the trap. "Honey, what's the matter?" "Nothing." "What do you mean nothing? That response makes me feel like you're angry at me." "I'm not angry." "Well, you seem angry. What's bugging you? Did something happen today?" "No, I don't want to talk about it." Talk about what? Nothing. Are we going to do this all night? Oh, like you care. All you ever do is come home and ask a couple things about my day, but you never really listen. You have no idea what I have to deal with at home all day. The kids, the cooking, the cleaning. All you ever do is go golfing with your buddies. You don't care about anybody but yourself. Huh? Honey, how long have you been feeling this way? Yeah, like you care. When was the last time you told me you love me? Of course, you can't remember. I didn't think you could. When was the last time you got me flowers? Oh, there was the one time, yeah, I didn't think so. You want to know when? Before we got married, that's when. I remember. You don't care. I don't even know why I'm talking to you. She storms out. He is left wondering how in the world all this happened. The next day, he comes home with flowers, and he says, I love you, but it doesn't fix the problem. The only reason you brought me these flowers is because I told you to. That's a pretty nasty picture. You'll never find a resolution when communication looks like that. The wife is afraid because her needs aren't getting met, and her needs aren't getting met because she's afraid to communicate them. When she gets her husband to act by coercion, it can't meet her need, because her real need can only be met by a free act of love. The only way she can show the real problem is to overcome her fear, trust that he cares about her, and tell him what she needs. The Blu-ray and the TV. Communicating the message, I care about your needs, at the beginning of a respectful conversation is crucial. The next step is discovering what the need is through the process of sending and receiving clear messages to one another. In order for this process to be successful, you must have both a speaker and a listener. If either component is missing, you either have silence or a collective monologue, not a conversation. I like to illustrate this process with a TV and a DVD player. Imagine that you have a beautiful 60-inch flat-screen 3D television and a top-of-the-line Blu-ray disc player. In order for this entertainment system to work, you need all the correct cables plugged into the right spots. When you put your favorite movie into the Blu-ray player, it will read its contents and send the information through the cables to the TV. The TV will then interpret that information and turn it into images. In a respectful conversation, one of you is the Blu-ray player and the other is the TV. It is very important that you only play one of these roles at a time, or you'll end up with a processing error. If you are the Blu-ray player, your job is to read the contents of your thoughts, feelings, and needs, and send a clear message about those contents to the TV. The TV's job is to receive that message and display it back to you. Only when you both agree that the message has been successfully communicated and understood can you switch roles or begin to discuss solutions. Of course, we're humans, not machines, so sending and receiving messages to one another is going to be a little more dynamic and take a little more time and effort. As the Blu-ray player, you might struggle to read the disc of what's going on inside of you, especially if you're dealing with fear and don't have a lot of practice identifying your needs. You're probably going to throw a bunch of messages to the TV that are still in some kind of a jumbled code. The TV person's job is to help you decipher that code by asking questions. Is this what you're saying? Is this the message you want me to receive? Is this what you're feeling? None of these questions should be asked or interpreted as judgments, but as honest attempts to clarify what you, the Blu-ray player, have said. As you hear the TV feeding back your message to you, you'll be able to identify discrepancies and make corrections. No, that's not what I was trying to say at all. Let me try this again. I'm actually feeling... As the Blu-ray player, it's your responsibility to stick to reading your disc and not offer your opinions and judgments of the TV. The minute you start to say, you this, you that, the connection cables are in danger of shorting out. If you're the TV on the receiving end of a you attack, you might try to give the Blu-ray player a pass and see if they are willing to reframe their you message into an I message. All right, so you sound scared and hurt when this happens. Is that what you're saying? No, I'm not scared. I'm mad. All right, but you're probably mad because you don't have control over this. Is that what you're saying? Yes. I don't have any control. Okay, well, what are you going to do about that? How can I help you? If the Blu-ray player does not respond to this approach and swings back to talking about you, you will need to set a boundary. Hey, this conversation just got disrespectful. I'm happy to continue when you're ready to show me your heart instead of telling me what's wrong with me. Every respectful conversation needs one speaker and one listener at all times. Two Blu-ray players cannot communicate with one another. They will never know what movies they are trying to play until they hook up with the TV. No one listening means there is no more conversation. Creating resolution, choosing to serve. Though it does require humility and vulnerability for the Blu-ray player to show the TV what is going on inside of them, the listening role is the true servant role in a respectful conversation. The listener affirms, right now, this conversation is about you and your needs. I'm here to help you figure them out and find a way to help you get them met. But in the end, the listener is really the winner. If I listen well, I have two vital pieces of information, what you need and what I need to do. With these two pieces of information, I start to identify and take ownership of the problem and create an effective solution. If the husband of the hurting wife becomes a skilled listener, he's going to say, okay, she isn't saying that she needs flowers. She needs to feel loved. I take ownership for meeting that need. How can I serve her and show her I care? Hey, honey, I got us a babysitter, a helicopter, and 3 nights at the beach. Let's go. A skilled listener with a servant's heart is the deadliest weapon against the fear bombs that threaten connection. And when you get two skilled listeners working together, watch out. They are ninjas at keeping fear away from their connection. As they engage in the mutual dance of going low and serving one another, they are going to remove all doubt that they care for one another. They are going to operate with the assumption, you care about my needs and I care about your needs. We are going to invite and offer the exchange of truth every day in our relationship and stay connected. The more connection becomes the normal state of the relationship, the more quickly you will recognize signs of disconnection and be able to nip them and their potential deadly side effects in the bud. Not too long ago, Sherry and I disconnected over something. It was a remarkable experience because we both noticed how strange it felt. Although we spent years in disconnection at the beginning of our relationship, we had been connected for so long that it was blindingly obvious that something was not right. We started a conversation. This has been going on for an hour. Does that feel weird to you? Yeah, it feels weird to me. I hate it. You want a cup of coffee? Sure. You want to sit on the couch with me? Sure. We knew the first item that we had to tackle was a reconnection. After that, we were able to resolve the issue very easily. Most problems are solved in the momentum of protecting connection. But even when connecting does not solve a problem, it helps keep the problem under control. For example, I recently had a 180-degree disagreement with an important leader in my life. We were like two freight trains moving in the opposite direction, and it went on for months. After 1 hour of intense disagreement in a conflict resolution meeting, I told him, I'm afraid that this disagreement is going to injure our relationship. I'm never going to let that happen, he said. To this day, he and I disagree strongly about something very important to both of us, but we protect our relationship. Together, we keep elevating our relationship above that issue in our hearts and our minds. This affects how I treat him, how I talk about him, and how I talk to him. I refuse to let our disagreement intimidate me into moving away from him. I know that if I can prioritize connection in the midst of conflict, I'm going to have something even more powerful to hold on to down the road. So what can you take away from this chapter? Well, first of all, get started on your relational connection fitness plan. Get off the couch and start strengthening the cords of connection. Start respectful conversations by clarifying that you care deeply about the other person's needs. Then, send and receive clear messages. Don't participate in a conversation with someone who doesn't want to be respectful too. Choose to keep your love on, nuke fear, believe the best about people, and trust them to care. If they don't care, forgive them. Move towards those you love, even when it hurts. Section 3, Boundaries. Chapter 8, Levels of Intimacy. My friends Bob and Linda used to live like many well-meaning, good-hearted people do. And for the longest time, they couldn't figure out why their lives were always stressful, financially strained, and in the relational survival mode. Bob had a great talent for fixing cars and always helped his friends out with their cars for free, even though he couldn't really afford it. Right before his little girl's 7th birthday party, he got a call from a friend saying that the car he fixed for free the previous weekend had broken down again. The friend begged Bob to come right away because he had to get somewhere ASAP. Bob kissed his little girl on the head and went to work on the car. After returning home late that night, he and Linda had another argument over how his friends and their car problems seemed to be more important than their family. But Bob couldn't figure out why using his talent to help people could be a problem. He saw it as his ministry. Meanwhile, Linda had 2 friends whose daughters were getting married. Neither could afford to buy clothes for the bridal parties. Linda is a really good seamstress, so she offered to sew all the dresses for both weddings for free. She sewed nonstop for 2 months. She missed a piano recital and a Little League championship game because she was running out of time to finish the project. Her commitments to help her friends brought a high level of stress into her life, but she powered through because that's what she was supposed to do. She was serving. As for Bob and Linda's kids, well, they constantly heard their stressed out, financially strapped, unavailable parents say, "This is ministry, kids." But the lessons they were learning was that ministry prioritizes the needs of strangers before everyone in the family. Bob and Linda were not practicing ministry. They were practicing a life without healthy boundaries. They were on the road to destroy their relationship with each other, their children, and eventually those they were trying to serve, because they did not know how to establish and protect appropriate levels of intimacy in their lives. Levels of intimacy. This might be news to you, but not everyone should have the same access to you. You are responsible to manage different levels of intimacy, responsibility, influence, and trust with people in your life. Likewise, you are responsible to honor the different levels of access and influence others allow you to have in their lives. These levels are absolutely righteous, healthy, normal, and good. It is supposed to be like this. It has to be like this. When we expect that we should all have equal access to one another, we are setting ourselves up to violate and be violated. For many Christians, this is difficult to grasp. We have core values of honor, love for the poor, serving others, laying down our lives, and being the hands and feet of Jesus. It's easy to think that it is spiritual to offer all people unlimited access to our lives. But everyone who tries to do this eventually discovers that it is not sustainable, healthy, or spiritual at all. Here's an idea of what happens when you don't set boundaries around the levels of access and intimacy with the people in your life. Say that you have been married for a while and have a few kids and a dog. Your husband comes to you and says, "Honey, Buster is cold sleeping out on the back porch. Do you think he could stay in here with us tonight?" You hesitate because you don't want one night with a 200-pound bull mastiff in your room to turn into every night. But since you don't want to upset your husband, you agree. The next night he asks, "Honey, little Joey is having nightmares again. Can he sleep in here with us? It will just be for one night." A few weeks later, you have Buster, little Joey, not-so-little Susie, and a pet gerbil all sleeping in your room. Not too long after that, your husband asks if his brother can borrow a few $100s to pay off a debt. Susie goes on an outreach and meets Debbie, who was homeless until she moved into your house, and now your husband's brother's crack-addicted friend is now knocking on your door asking for more money to pay off the debts he owes. Hello? This is not a good Christian life. This is a panic attack. To see the pattern for the Christian life, we must look at Jesus. When we do, we see that Jesus prioritized certain relationships over others. He did not offer the same level of access and intimacy to everyone around him. First and foremost, his primary allegiance was always to the Father. At 12 years old, he was already about his Father's business.